This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home. Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and we're excited to welcome today's guest. The great Muddy Waters once said that everyone takes the blues where you find it, but it's up to you to pick it up and move it further down the road. Now, that's not just words to our guest this evening. He takes this very seriously, but he's not just an accomplished touring blues musician. No, sir. This guy is also a studio musician. He's a scorer of movies and TV shows, a painter, an incredible artist with several adult coloring books to his credit, and a celebrity counselor at Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. Now, there's a lot more to lay out here. Let's just cut to the chase and welcome our guest, Michigan native and now Floridian transplant, Rusty Wright and his lovely wife, Lori. Thank you both for joining us on Time Signatures. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Rusty, I have to dig right in here because there's so much ground to cover. I want to have you talk about your start in music. What got you started and where did you go once you started rolling with it?
Oh, well, I actually was born into a very musical family on my mother's side. She was a really great singer. I actually used to sing opera when she was in college, and her and all those ladies would be at the house around the piano working on those, you know, four-part harmonies and all those, you know, classical pieces. And when I was a little infant, so I was hearing music and harmony and melody, you know, from the very day one. And then later on, she started a very successful Southern gospel group called Temples in the 60s. She actually tried to dissuade me from being a musician. She was like, you're not going to be one of those. I deal with them. And she was against it. But finally, she relented because, you know, she knew I had the spark and there was nothing going to stop me. Because, I mean, when I was a kid, she wouldn't buy me a guitar at first because she thought it was a phase. And so I cut grass and did, you know, odd jobs around the neighborhood until I had enough money to go buy this horrible piece of junk at a garage sale because I didn't know. I just thought it looked cool.
Yeah, you thought it looked cool.
And so I brought it home and my mom was irritated at first. Then she picked it up and played on it a little bit. She was like, no, you go ahead. She realized that the action was so high and so stiff on this guitar. She thought for sure I'd give up and never, you know, be able to do that. Well, I worked my fingers to the bone to the point where they actually did bleed a couple of times just so hard to press those strings down. But I finally got three chords to come out of the thing and sound decent. And she finally looked at my dad and said, oh, he's not going to quit. So my first official gig was playing in her backup band. She said, if you're going to be a musician, you're going to be in the backup band where I can keep my eye on you. You know, being a Michigander, I was surrounded by all the Motor City stuff and all the 70s rock guys. But my dad was a real lover of music. He couldn't play, but he loved music, had a big record collection. So I had all the Chess records and all the Southern, you know, soul and stuff that he had collected, you know, as he was growing up. And I would listen to all that stuff all the time. So I tell people I'm a creature of extremes, you know, from one side of the country to the other.
Well, I love that you've never forgotten your blues roots right here in the state of Michigan. And from what I gather, you guys work hard to get up here every year, don't you?
Yeah, except for the COVID years. That put a big monkey wrench in everything for a while. But yeah, now we do our very best to go out every year and travel across the country and see everybody back, you know, in Michigan during the summer months.
I want to talk about your brand of the blues, Rusty, because you're not the cookie cutter blues guy, are you?
No. I mean, you know,
it's a mixed blessing.
To be honest, it's a harder row to hoe than when you want to try to do things and be a little experimental and a little innovative. because, you know, not to be rude or anything, God bless people that love blues, you know, foundation, but sometimes they end up building a barrier to people who are just basically trying to take it farther down the road because they, you know, they're afraid that somehow something will be lost. And that's not really, you know, the case. You can't stick the blues in a box. It'll wither and die, you know. You got to let people do what they want to do with it because there's so much expression in it. And there's so much music out there now that's people are far more sophisticated listeners than they've been in the past. You know, before you only had your local radio station and whatever records you and your friends managed to find at the local record store. Now you can go on the internet and you can find music from anywhere in the world, any style, any genre, anything. So giving them interesting little twists and throwing in some cool little, you know, left turns in the music is just, it's fun. It's, and people get a kick out of it. They like the, you know, the harmonies and the maybe there's a little bit of an edge here that's kind of on the rocky side. Maybe there's a little Southern soul thing on this side. And some of the songs that I write, like Last Days of Whitey Malone, is actually almost, you know, a little bit on the progressive rock side because of all the changes. Even though we're doing things that are very traditional swing, jazz, blues, it's still because of all the time changes and the, you know, the
key changes,
modulations
and stuff.
And stuff. Yeah, it's almost progressive at the same time.
There's no defining that one.
I like the fact that, you know, there's so many musicians out there that are like you that are saying, I'm going to play what I'm going to play. Joe Bonamassa being a good example. Even Buddy Guy is not a straight blues guy anymore. He mixes a little bit of everything in there. I think that it's kind of indicative of, as you said, the listener becoming more educated and being a lot more savvy than they used to be. They demand a little bit more. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the giving people something cool and that's a surprise, you know, that they're not expecting. You look at a crowd at a place and they're all tuned out and they're looking at their phone. It's not because the band is bad. It's because the band is just playing it safe and doing stuff that they've heard 1,000 times before. So they're not surprised and they're not engaged. But you give them a little shock value for a second, you know, throw something at them with all kinds of wild twists and turns and cool, you know, playing and really, you know, extreme, exceptional, you know, style playing and stuff. And, you know, slowly but surely, when we play, I watch the eyes and I watch the head start to bob up. And it's like, it's almost like they wake up and they go, hey, what was that?
And it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. I mean, there's people who want to eat ramen noodles every day or steak every day, and that's all they want. And that's fine. That's them. But we just like mixing it up a little more, and I think most people appreciate that.
Lori, I have to tell you, I've got a very good friend. We argue about the blues all the time, and I joke with him. I call him a blues snob because he loves the blues. He loves the... Yeah. Straight down the line, rough edge, muddy, gritty blues. And that's okay. And I've told him, we don't have to agree. You don't have to like my brand of the blues. I don't have to like yours. I happen to like yours because I like a little bit of everything. But I think that, you know, that it lends itself when you start talking to blues aficionados these days that they do enjoy the mix. And I mean, I was looking at Bonamassa's followers on Facebook. It's like hundreds of thousands. So don't tell me that he doesn't have a following. There's at least almost 1 million followers of his on Facebook alone.
Joe used to come up to Flint and play at a little place called the Bauer Theater. He would play and there would be 12 people the first time.
Yeah.
But the next time he came back, there'd be 20 or 30. The next time he came back, there'd be 50.
And he was renting out that theater every time. He wasn't coming in for a paycheck. They were paying for the theater and just building the old school way, which is really hard these days. It's almost impossible to do now.
Finding the venues in the first place that can rent to you that you can do the shows in is getting harder because a lot of them are closing down. Yeah. Then the prices that they want are exorbitant. Yeah. Everything's gone up in price. But then on top of that, people, once again, because of the internet, because of streaming and all the other services out there, it's getting harder to get folks motivated to want to invest the money in a ticket. When I was coming up, everybody was always searching for new music all the time. Me and my friends, the first thing we did when we got, you know, got our allowance or our first paychecks was run down to the local mall and hit the record stores and see what, yep. what had just come out, you know.
Columbia right. Record Club.
I got to ask you a question, Rusty. When you guys came up to play at TC's place in Napoleon, when you guys were on your way up, you stopped at Sweetwater. Your wife made you do something, didn't she? Tell that story, man.
Well, we were on the road, you know, and we were coming up to Michigan and stuff, but we had a little time to kill, and you know, we'd never seen the main Sweetwater Sound complex there. But we went to check it out. That's I was really just amazed at all the stuff they had there. So I'm wandering around, you know, looking at stuff and made my way through the recordings gear and other stuff. And then finally headed over to the guitars. And so I'm thinking, yeah, they got all the standard stuff, you know, no big thing. And when I got in there, I was looking around and lo and behold, my eye catches this Les Paul that's got that slightly different headstock. And I thought, oh God, what is that? And I went over and looked and it was a Heritage.
It was funny because he walked through the door and he just looked around and then he went, me, 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 me. And right, zeroed in on that and to the wall he went. And I went, oh, here we go.
Well, I don't buy a ton of guitars. I have a nice little collection, but they're all guitars that I have found that really have something sweet and special and click with me, you know. I don't just buy guitars to buy guitars and have them, you know. I want guitars that really feel good and really reach inside me when I play them. Sure. And I got that guitar out, and as soon as I picked it up, I mean, I've always loved that
look at his face.
I started playing it, and I was like, oh, expletive, which I'm trying not to say out loud.
Beep.
And I plugged it into a nice amp, you know, and started noodling around, and it was just like instantaneous.
His eyes just started to glow, and I pulled my credit card out of my back pocket and I went, oh, just go buy it, just go get it, you know, it's coming home with us. I can tell by the look on your face.
And I have to tell you, you have to go to their website and you have to scroll down and look at the Blues Blast magazine article. Now, I was there that night. I shot pictures of the first time he played that guitar in a concert. And all I can say is the pure delight, the childlike wonder in your face. It was like Christmas morning. It really was. And
I got the biggest kick out of that, too, that night.
Yeah, and when I expressed that to Lori and I showed her the picture, she goes, oh my God, look at his face. And I said, yeah. So it did my heart good because I was able to capture a moment that to me was just something that you don't see all the time. And it's wonderful to see that kind of response in the face of a musician.
That's one of my favorite pictures of him ever.
Thank you.
Where he's just grinning in that denim shirt.
Yep. Rusty, I want to flip the page here a little bit because you've got some great stories, man, and I want to get these stories preserved here. Talk about opening for Lynyrd Skynyrd. That was like a once-in-a-lifetime thing for you, wasn't it?
That was very, very unique, unexpected. I decided I was fed up with all the metal and rock scene stuff. We'd been playing together as a duo kind of thing and enjoying working on the harmonies and stuff. I'd always told myself that I was going to play the blues if I hit 40 and I was still alive and kicking, I was going to play music that I loved.
And that was what I wanted to do too for many years and never had anybody to work with that liked that type of music.
But we had decided to do it, start working on the blues band seriously. And we had just gotten our very first lineup together. And we had been working on songs and working on original and writing, you know, material for a record.
First album.
And I decided, okay, we need to go out and play in front of a crowd and see what kind of reaction we get. See if people like what we're doing. We're on the right course. And so we played this little barbecue joint. It wasn't a lot of people. I mean, we had a good crowd, but it was a small place.
Yeah.
But we got a really good, you know, reception, a really good vibe from it. We thought, okay, cool. This is a good start. So our very first gig, you know, is with the new Blues Rusty Wright Band, is at a little barbecue joint in front of about 50 people. they had a nice night. Everything went well.
Nobody threw anything. It was a good day in showbiz.
So I decided, okay, I guess I'll start contacting, you know, my friends and other people I know in the industry and let them know that I've got a new thing, you know, and that I'm looking to get some stuff rolling. I hadn't even started to dial the phone yet when I get this phone call from an agent friend of mine who had heard that I had a new band, and she had just had a cancellation. She says, I just had a cancellation by the opener for Lynyrd Skynyrd. I heard you had up a new act. Can you do it? And it's like a week away, or, you know, wow. I'm like, what's the date? And it turned out it was June 9th, which is our anniversary.
It was our third anniversary.
Yeah. And Lori had made me promise that year, in fact, she said, we're always working on our anniversary. We're always working on all our holidays. This year, will you promise me don't book anything on our anniversary?
And I didn't think it was going to be a tough thing because it was a Wednesday night.
So I actually told the agent, I said, okay, you got to give me 2 minutes. I got to call somebody. I got to make sure that everyone's available.
Like, what?
And she's like, are you kidding? I said, no, please bear with me. I got to do this now, but I'll be right back. She said, okay, don't wait. Don't make me wait long. Okay, I'll be right back. So then I call Lori and say, I start off with a, hey, I know I promised that I wouldn't book anything. And she's like, you know, she's already instantly chewing my ear. And I'm, no, listen to me. This is totally up to you. It's your decision. We can go out and have a fantastic, marvelous anniversary dinner with all the trimmings and spend a beautiful evening together and just relax and enjoy ourselves and have a nice time. Or we can open for Lynyrd Skynyrd in front of a sold out audience at the Clio Amphitheater. And I held the phone back as the squealing started. And I'm like, in between her screaming, I'm like, that's a yes, right?
Gotta call you back.
Yeah, and I called the agent back and said, yeah, we're on, good to go. And she's like, oh, thank God. All right, great. Day of the show, it's tornado season.
Tornado.
So the weather is crap and everything is like touch and go. They might cancel the show if there's a tornado touchdown.
They
too
spent
close.
The whole day down underneath the facility.
So finally, like, I don't know, half hour before showtime, they get the all clear to go for it. And so
it's still pouring rain.
Yeah,
it's still raining. Storming, but they decided to go ahead with the show because 4,000 people were sitting there was leaving.
Yeah, they all came. They're all covered in Visqueen and wearing rain gear, but they're not moving. They are there to see a show.
Wow.
So at the last second, you know, the skies start to clear up, everything is cool. They fly the trusses. They hadn't even flown the lighting trusses because they weren't sure if they were going to be able to until the last second. So big chain motors crank everything up. The big light top goes up. You know, everything's ready to go. And we go up there and hit the stage, do our thing. Now, we've got 30 minutes, and I'm playing in front of Lynyrd Skynyrd, who have some of the best guitar players there are.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, we got to go for broke. I got to hit him with everything I got, or this audience is going to just, you know, eat us alive. And so we threw down with an instrumental that I had just written called Hell on My Heels. That's, you know, real guitar driven, crazy stuff. And it worked out great. Audience loved it, started cheering. Next thing you know, they're digging it. We're getting a real good response, really good response. The Skynyrd guys were downstairs in their dressing rooms, and they said they heard all that roaring and applause and stuff and decided they needed to go find out what the hell's happening upstairs. And I look over to my right as I'm standing on stage playing, and there on stage right behind the big curtains is all three guitar players with their arms crossed.
I saw them first, and I look at Rusty, and I'm like,
yeah. Yeah, she walks over and stops her head, and I look over, and it's like, oh, my God. I'm thinking to myself, this is either really good or really, really, really bad.
And it was?
It ended up being great, yeah. But I swear I was so nervous about that. We finished the show. Thank you. Good night. Got a standing ovation. I ran off the other direction to the other side of the stage.
He was afraid they were going to grab at him.
I'd set up in the wrong place or done something.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just trying to pack my guitar up and, you know, the road crew's grabbing the gear and stuff. And I look and there's all three guitar players walking down the causeway behind the stage that where nobody can see.
They were probably pretty irritated at that point because they had to go all the way back around through the building, all the way around.
But they did. They came over there to that side of the thing, and Ricky Medlock himself walked right up to me and grabbed my hand and pumped it and said, dude, where the hell did you come from? And we were pals after that. I mean, it was, they said, stick around. They invited us back to the dressing room and all that good stuff. We got to hang out and see the show and hang out with Lynyrd Skynyrd. And it was just one of those unbelievably perfect days.
Yeah, it was.
All right. I usually ask my musician friends to give me their best story and their worst story. And you had both of them on your website. So I'm going to ask you about this. I would like you to detail the Armed Forces tour in South Korea. Would you share that story?
That came about, again, through that song, Hell on My Heels.
Okay.
There was a podcaster out of California named Mike Yusey, and he had a lot of listeners that were over in Iraq and Afghanistan and all through there, and they were downloading his podcast.
And he was a supporter of ours. He liked the music a lot, so he
played
us
constantly. And so he told us that the guys had written to him and said they had downloaded that song and they were using it when they would go out on patrol outside of the green zone. They were blasting that as they went through the gates.
Yeah, because when the gates fly open, they come out really fast because they never know if their insurgents would be on the other side with a, you know, rocket launcher or whatever. So they would pick a song that was really wild
aggressive.
And scary and aggressive, and they would pump it loud as hell through the sound systems that they had mounted on the Jeeps and the vehicles, and they'd come tearing out of there with this, and they started off with that song of ours, Hell on My Heels, because it's got this crazy wild guitar, screaming guitar intro thing.
Once we heard that, we said, we've got to go play for them. Let's go.
looked into it and found the Armed Forces Entertainment.
Yep.
Yeah.
We went over there and we did, what, 9 shows, I think? We only had one day off.
Yeah, the schedule was really
cool. It was travel that was included in that. There were flights and things like that.
The schedule was incredibly grueling. Basically they run it like a military operation. So they've got you, you know, your day is worked out down to the minute.
And if you're over 25, oh my gosh, we were exhausted, but it was great. It was a fabulous experience.
Yeah. I love playing for the guys over there, you know, and it was really amazing. And seeing, you know, South Korea, and Seoul is bigger than New York City, you know, and it's just immense.
Yeah.
And seeing all the different cultures and stuff, and Japan, of course, and, you know, seeing all the marvelous things and meeting all the people was definitely, definitely fantastic.
That's amazing. One more question for you before we wrap up here. I mean, this interview has just been an incredible amount of fun. I have to ask you about your 2022 concept album, Hanging at the DeVille Lounge. Now, having lived in Flint in the early 80s, I'm eager to hear more about the backstory on this.
Well, the DeVille was a real place. It was a shop bar, but it had been there for ages.
Yeah.
You know, there'd been entire decades of people who had lived and died and had come through that bar. And, you know,
every town has them.
Yeah. The thing about it that I always liked was that they had a great sense of humor. I remember, you know, there was a shop on one corner, the DeVille across the street, and a little church on the opposing corner. And the church pastor, the DeVille was, you know, they were noted for partying quite excessively. In fact, a lot of times after 2 o'clock when they were supposed to be closed, they just locked the doors and people would keep on drinking.
We can say that now, it's closed.
Yeah, it's gone. People would keep on drinking in there till dawn, and then they'd wander out, you know, on Sunday morning. They had a takeout license, so they would leave with lots of beer cans and other stuff. And the pastor got irritated finally because he kept finding, you know, empty beer cans and cigarette butts all over the lawn, the front lawn of the church, you know, because they'd be roaming around all across the, you know, the intersection there. So he finally got himself, you know, one of those little lighted signs you wheel out to the front, start putting their little slogans on, and, you know, he put on his and faced it right at the DeVille and said, "Come to church.
Sinners welcome.
Sinners welcome." He thought he was being cool and clever and facing it right at the DeVille and all those people that went there. So the guy at the DeVille bought one of those signs and put it up on his roof with all the lights and flashing stuff on there. And he puts on his sign, "Sinners welcome here too, and we have beer."
In our minds, it was all kind of a mixture of places that we've been to over the years. There are places that just leave an impression.
It's basically the album pays homage to all those marvelous little places like that, the incubator for all of the music that happened all through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Yeah. You know, it was guys plying their trade in these little tiny places like that that held 50 people or so.
And it just feels like it permeates the walls.
Yeah.
You know, that music, that vibe, the spirit that's in there. And the people who are true music lovers, ones who follow it, that it's like a religion to them, they're always going to the next show and looking for the next show. They feel it instantly when they walk through the doors of those places, like Bradfordville Blues Club in Tallahassee.
Oh, yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, well, so basically the hanging at the DeVille Lounge is just my paying homage to that beautiful little incubator of all those clubs across the United States that were the place where all the music came from, you know.
And there's drama and, you know, people live their lives in those environments. And so there's drama and sadness and love and all kinds of
everything you can think of. Life passes through those walls.
Life in general.
Well, as we come to a close, I want to ask you, where can listeners and viewers go to find out more about the Rusty Wright Band? Where can we find the music, the coloring books? Where can they go for this?
Well, the main website is rustywrightband.com. And, you know, that's W-R-I-G-H-T, right? So rustywrightband.com is the main site where you can find our music, see more videos, see all our press stuff. You can buy the coloring books there. You can buy T-shirts and our, you know, albums, whatever you like.
Well, Rusty and Lori, it has been a pleasure to talk to you and have you on the program. Of course, you know, if you guys put something out in the future, reach out. We would love to have you back. And thank you again for being here with us. We appreciate it. And to our listeners, but we want to thank you all for being here. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive, well, that's our goal. But preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
Sharing the voices of Lansing Community College. Visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College has been a proud collaborator of the Lansing Promise Scholarship since 2012. The Lansing Promise Scholarship offers graduating high school seniors who live within the Lansing School District and attend a high school within district boundaries an opportunity to attend LCC. Since its inception, over 1,000 enrolled students have saved over $2 million, earning over 400 degrees and certificates, as well as 30,000 credits at LCC. For more information on the Lansing Promise Scholarship, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
Yeah, I wanna go outside, I wanna be.
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast.
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Feeling froggy? Well, leap into 20-plus podcasts at lccconnect.org.
Art Happens Here, the podcast that explores the often curious and occasionally amazing art installations on, in, and around the campuses of Lansing Community College. I'm your host, Bruce Mackley.
Listen to this program and many others on demand at lccconnect.org.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The Modern Warehousing Program through the Job Training Center at Lansing Community College is an industry-led program that prepares individuals for frontline material handling and supply chain logistic positions in medical centers, fulfillment centers, warehouses, and factories. Those who complete this program can earn multiple certifications. Visit lcc.edu/JTCtraining for more information.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
It's time for Stars on Sports,
a podcast radio show dedicated to sharing stories about our athletic program at Lansing Community College.
LCC Athletics has a strong tradition.
24 national championship wins.
Over 170 All-Americans.
19 MCCAA All-Sports trophies.
Stars on Sports will introduce you to individuals that have contributed to our program's success and give you the backstory on what it takes to develop it.
We'll also dive into and break down the topics and issues facing athletic departments across the nation and right here at LCC.
This is Stars on Sports.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Stars on Sports. I'm joined today by our assistant athletic director, Stephen Cutter, and our producer, Dedalian Lowry. And gentlemen, today we're going to be talking about the lifeblood of an athletic administrator's job, and that coaching, our coaching staff. And, you know, I got into this business because I had great coaches growing up that had a significant impact on me and were very influential. And being a leader of coaches, they inspire me every day. And, you know, when I have a coaches meeting, I always put the quote by Billy Graham on the bottom of it: a coach impacts more people in a year than most people do in a lifetime. And, you know, coaches always surprise me when I think I get to know them. They, you know, might go a different direction, but for the most part, they are who they are. And, you know, their strengths are what make them be successful. So I wanted to kind of talk about that because I listen to a lot of leadership podcasts, and obviously, some of the same characteristics that a successful CEO or a successful president of a bank has are the same characteristics that successful coaches have. And the other neat thing about leadership, or and especially in coaching staffs, is there's different ways of doing things. It just, you know, every coach is different, and, you know, it just what works for them, and they can be successful by being who they are instead of everyone has to be a model or of the same mode. And, you know, I'd hire a lot of coaches over my career, and I've revamped my list of what I'm looking for. And we'll talk about that through this podcast.
The list.
Yeah. Nice. The list. Nice. I got to find it in my pile here. I might've forgot it actually, but it's here and there. I know it.
Old school paper.
I am that. Post-its. We've been joking about post-its in my office over last week. How many I
have?
Hey,
I do that. So,
yeah. So, you know, but it's evolved, and, but some of them have stayed true. You know, in my previous job, at a lower level of athletic competition, one of the main premises was if a coach could communicate and was organized, they could be successful because of the audience they were dealing with. But I truly believe that's kind of true for every leadership, especially communication, because I learned a long time ago, communication is at the root of all problems and it solves all problems. So my previous level too, I looked for English teachers because they had a background in communication. So I thought English teachers made great coaches, but in that same sense, teachers make great coaches. Coaches are teachers. That's what it boiled down to. I saw an article a couple of years ago that really stuck with me. I loved it. Is when you look back at the word coach, it in the old days, it was a carriage that took people from one place to the next. Mm-hmm. And that's what coaches do, taking student athletes from one place to the next. I think it's a very fitting word. So Coach, any initial thoughts on coaching characteristics? I'd like to talk about head coaching, assistant coaching, and that. But again, I just like some general things, and that was kind of the direction we head.
Yeah, leadership. I think I certainly am excited to dive into this a little bit and trying to completely understand the direction you want to go with it. But I believe there are strong parallels between athletics and the business world, and CEOs and presidents and everything else. There are very strong characteristics. I like the initial understanding that a coach was taking people from one place to another. There's also the piece of it that sometimes there's just not enough room on that carriage to get everybody to where they need to go.
Really?
And so there's that whole world there as well.
Yeah. And I think Dedalia, and I'll get to you in a second. I think most coaches do a great job of getting as many people on that carriage to that next place. What about you, Dedalia? And even in, you know, I think of you in music all the time for some reason, but
sure,
even in the music world, you know, what are your thoughts of?
Well, I mean, it comes down to leadership really is what you're talking about. And to me, it just seems like there's been quite a bit of shift over the last, I don't know how many years, but where empathy has become a little bit more prevalent and significant in being in a leadership role, as well as emotional intelligence. So.
Excellent. It's
incredible. Emotional toughness as well.
Yeah.
Intelligence and the toughness. And I do believe that the empathy is greater. I know one thing that I kind of stand by is state the facts and speak the truth and that is the communication style that I use with student athletes and with people that I coach. But there's also lines, you know, some things that I won't touch is belief systems. If somebody has a higher belief system than maybe what they are, I really don't touch that piece of it because those are really hard to build. You can start working on building the skills, but not necessarily touch the belief system because if they have something higher where they're believing in themselves, that's an extremely positive thing. They think they're better than what they are. That's a very positive thing versus the 180 of it where they just don't believe that they can lead or do or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And back to Dedalian's point, I think even in coaching in athletics, that's been a significant shift of going from like authoritarian dictator coach in charge to empathy and being more player emphasis. And just again, I think empathy is even in the athletic world has been a more emphasis and shift and for the good. I mean, you also talk about emotional intelligence, which is a real hot topic in leadership nowadays. And I listened to a great podcast and talking to the coach about this, but the CEO of Whole Foods, the previous one, he talked about emotional intelligence, for those who don't know, is self-awareness and empathy. Those are the two things that he used, and how important that is in building a team. And he talked about emotional intelligence and hiring people, which is a good segue for his characteristics, where he wanted intelligent people. He wanted people with drive. He wanted people that he could trust. And his number one characteristic was integrity, people of integrity, and then caring. And to me, that last one is one of my biggest ones, is someone that cares, because I think they'll do that extra mile. And my favorite quote that I also use on a coach's agenda is, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And knowledge is overrated to me in hiring for some reason. Just I think because the applicant pool I get, that's one that's usually pretty equal. I mean,
also are a Ted Lasso fan.
Yes, I am. Which I think a lot of certain characteristics there that apply to hiring good people or being around good people. So, caring is a big one. But, you know, I was just listening to one of our previous podcasts about kindness and kindness versus competitiveness. And that same thing goes true, because I want a competitive person too. I want a person that has high expectations. You know, another person said championship expectations. And that's what we want, because we do compete at this level. And I think that best balance of caring and being competitive is something it's hard to maybe go through in an interview process, depending on the length of that interview process. But those are, you know, besides, you know, in addition to communication, ones that I look for.
Yeah, and I think there is a balance piece of it, because even with the empathy piece, you can put yourself in other people's situations or shoes or whatever it might be and somewhat understand that. But with the coaching piece of it, you're trying to take them to a different level as well. And so you've got to, you know, not only understand where they're at to, mm-hmm. to be able to get them to the next spot.
And I think that's huge as a leader of coaches, is understanding your coaches, because I think that's one of my main jobs, is to develop coaches, help them get better, to challenge them, to work with them. Because in our world, as in every world, you get some coaches that are inexperienced and some that are very experienced, and knowing which way you want to go and keeping them improving. Because as we talk about moving forward, be better than yesterday is our main goal. But so yes, I definitely think what you're looking for, and even the difference between a head coach and assistant coach. And, you know, I look for assistant coaches that balance a staff, that it's kind of like a puzzle you put together. I don't want all yes people as assistant coaches. Mm-hmm. I want one that complement the skills of the head coach so that they are a puzzle that fits well together. But, and they're very important at our level, in all levels of because of the individual they deal with, how much they deal with student athletes on a given day. But the other big attribute that I think big at our level that we don't maybe emphasize, the programs that are really good emphasize it, but is recruiting. At this level, coaches have to be good recruiters.
Excellent recruiters.
Excellent. It's the lifeblood. And, you know, I talked to a D1 coach about 6 months ago, and he said I asked him what made their staff so successful, and he said recruiting, surrounding yourself with a good staff, and teaching leadership. And talking to a D2, one of the best D2 athletic directors in history, he would do a recruiting shop every year with his coaching staff, a 2-day recruiting shop, making sure they're all on the same page of how they recruit. And because it back to our brand too, that, you know, you got to recruit your brand, and we both talked about how winning can help with recruiting or successful. At this level, it wouldn't have been in my other job because you couldn't recruit, although you did have to go out and recruit the hallways. But recruiting is an integral part of at least the coaching leadership skill.
Yeah, for sure. With all the things that you're talking about, it's whether it's with intelligence, competitiveness, whatever it might be that you're looking for in people to grow, all those things can be built. They just take time. And it's much like putting 50 people in a weight room and having them all do the same exercise for 30 days. You're going to see significant growth in certain people, and you'll see less growth in others. And so you never really know. When you're recruiting, most of this stuff is really hard to measure. Really hard to measure. Mm-hmm. You might be seeing people when it's sunny and 75 and on their best day. And you might also show up to another place and you're seeing somebody on their worst day. And you can get some measurements from that kind of stuff, like how they're reacting, or, you know, whether they're selfish or selfless and some of their actions. But it's pretty difficult because a lot of this you just can't really measure.
And I think that's another nice pathway in the sense of, hiring's a gamble. I mean, I always joke that when people complain about a coach, be careful what you wish for. The grass isn't always greener on the other side. And just because a coach has a bad year doesn't mean they're a bad coach. I mean, it could just have been a bad fit. It could have been injuries. It could have been something. And we can define the definition of bad, because I see you over there smirking. But that's the other thing, too, and it's hard, is finding the best fit. Because just like I have who my favorite college is, and there's been, you know, certain hires in the past that they were the best coach available, but they weren't the best fit for that institution. So to your point of it, some things aren't measurable, and you're taking a risk anytime you hire that you're hoping it's a good fit for that program. So you got to know what you're looking for, and that's not always easy. I mean, usually when you hire, there's two reasons one, you probably fired someone and the situation needs correcting, or it's really good and that person moved on and you want someone to come in and try and build on that. So great point. But the other thing I think a struggle now too, when you talk about non-measurable, is patience. I don't think there's much patience nowadays with leadership that there was back then. We talked about on this podcast before, John Wooden didn't win his first national championship until like between the 13th and 16th year. And nowadays with social media, I mean, you got to win.
It's the world now. It's the world we live in. You know, we're not waiting to get messages from the mailbox anymore. You know, we're getting them instantaneously. And so it's just the world we live in. So there's going to be less patience, and it definitely applies in the sporting world, and people, you know, will be on people for one bad season, you know, and they don't have the necessarily the patience that people had for John Wooden and for him to and basically try to figure it out. I do believe one of the biggest things that I look for is intrinsic motivation, and that's an internal motivation where they are trying to become better people, better, you know, athletes, better in their community and things like that. And they're intrinsically motivated not for the materialistic things, whether it's the fame or the fortune or whatever it might be. They're focused on the things that maybe I would say matter the most. That you will find the most motivation anybody can have is intrinsically. And if you can develop and get people who are intrinsically motivated, you will go a lot farther, whether it's in the weight room or the boardroom.
First of all, I do like mail, and I do wait for mail in my mail. I check it every night, and I'm going to
really
with the timing of this podcast, I get a lot of political mail. I'm okay. Going to miss that.
Oh, I could build a house with the political
mail. I know,
mail
it's
I've
crazy.
Do you get your mail every day?
I do not. I tend to do it maybe once a week now.
Yes. Me as well.
Really?
Me as well, about once a week.
I get, like, if I come home and my daughter or wife hasn't checked the mail, I go out to the mailbox. There might be nothing, but. He's laughing at me. Yeah. Today.
You're an old soul.
I could probably check it once a week, but now with all the political mail, I don't know. I just like checking the mail. So I didn't mean to digress, but intrinsic motivation is a great one, because I think this ties into me, and I'd like you to tell me if I disagree, is passion. You know, mm-hmm. if a person had that passion, and you need it in this job.
Internal satisfaction is where that comes from. So yeah, for sure. Passion is huge.
And it's huge in this business because of, I guess, you know, as you move up the leadership hierarchy, the hours you put in, the stress you deal with dealing with other people's kids, that there's a lot, as I've always said, everyone's responsible for themselves. A leader is responsible for others, and in coaching that those others are kids or young adults. So, and how you can, you know, we've seen coaches' decisions that sent kids down different paths, whether they mm-hmm. stayed with that sport or whether they were, you know, had success. So back to that impact quote, it could be a negative thing for some, that having that passion carries you through because of, you know, like, you know, some people, if you have a 9-to-5 job, you go home and you come back the next day. When you're dealing with kids and sporting events that go to 10 o'clock at night, it never ends. You're always, you know, thinking, could they, you know, did they make it home safely on the bus? Did they make it home from the bus to their house? Did they get hurt at the game? So you're just constantly dealing with the stress of, you know, what could happen with young adults that we're responsible for.
Yeah. To play off that a little bit, it's kind of like Gladwell's book that he wrote about outliers, and everything affects everything. So it's just not the season that you have or the 4 years that you have with the people or the 10 years in your company. Everything affects everything, and where they've come from, their experiences that they've had, the modeling that they've had, the prior coaches, all that stuff affects everything. And I remember in that book, he talked about how important it was for, if you were going to be in an airplane crash, it wasn't just your pilot's training, but mm-hmm. where they came from
yep.
mattered.
Because if they could felt comfortable mm-hmm. communicating yes. during stress. Yes. Or, man, that yes. book's been popular on our podcast, mm-hmm. Outlier, so that's an interesting one. But yeah, same with the butterfly effect. Everything does affect everything, especially when you're a leadership, because it usually comes to you. Most people solve the easy ones. It's the difficult ones that make it to you. But
It's also a piece of it, as long as you understand that, then you may have a practice at at 11 a.m. or 4 o'clock, or you need to show up for work at 8 a.m., understanding that everything's affecting everything, that people are coming in with what we've talked about before with backpacks, and understanding through empathy and everything else, like how do you motivate through that, and how do you grow through everything that's, you know, already there.
And I think that the other thing that's changed in society and in our world, and I know you and your team do an excellent job, is teaching leadership. We used to use leadership as popularity, or that you couldn't teach it. It was you were born with it. But how much we've learned, back to what I said, that one coach, they taught leadership to their student athletes. And a majority of our teams do now because of we understand the importance of it. And because how important it is to have leaders among our team that, coach fed, player led, your motto that you use, that if a leader's the only one talking or teaching or learning, back to that, I think of having a strong assistant coaching staff, it gets old, it gets tuned out, where if you have players that are helping you spread that message and teach it. So I think that's another big change in society and business, is what we've learned about leadership and how we teach leadership. And I think the successful teams do teach leadership on a frequent basis. And, you know, we have 3 or 4 teams that do leadership training at least once a week. Journaling is another part of that.
It still comes down to respect. And I think it's most challenging at our level. It's not much different than being at a business and you've been there for 10 years and they bring somebody in that's been there for 10 weeks to be your new leader of your division or whatever. There's always a lack of respect that happens because of the seniority or the time frame there. And the same thing happens at our level, where if you're at a 4-year, it's a little bit different because you do have juniors and seniors that have put some time into a program, whatever that program might be. And so when they're providing leadership, there's a little more respect there because they've been a part of some type of journey and they understand. At our level, we really don't have that, being that it's a 2-year thing. So it's very often that the respect ends up being the biggest thing. Can this person respect this other person who's trying to lead? And it really starts with modeling.
Yeah. And again, a lot of attribute there. And one, to go back to what you talked about earlier, is trust and even telling the truth. Because in the end, leadership about, I think, relationships, developing relationships. It's about influence. It's about believing in your team to get them from one place to the next. So, because in the end, we don't like the word potential in our world, but our goal is from where we start. It's where we start, but where we finish, and getting them to a better place and being the best that we can in that time. Because in our world, you know, we deal with a lot of external factors, and it's a very public job. So we can probably make this a 3 or 4 part podcast. But you know, some of the things that I try and remind our coaches is believe in your student athlete. Back to Ted Lasso, back to your earlier comment about people's beliefs, that you got to believe you can win. You got to believe you can do it. Represent well. That's huge. I think as coaches, you're a very public figure, that you have to represent our institution well. Sportsmanship starts with them. If you're demonstrative or angry, I think that feeds off to the kids and then feeds off to the crowd. And then the communication part of it, not what you say, it's what they hear, and talking to every kid every day. Those are like some things that I try and emphasize with our coaching staff that help lead their team. So we'll end with that. I think we could probably dig more deeply into characteristics in the future. This went a lot of different ways than I thought. So for those that are still listening, I have a couple of questions that I a food one and my scenario one. So my favorite food is a hamburger. All right. And I could eat them every day of the week, probably 3 days a week. But I know it's not good for my heart, so I don't do that. But I do like, so what, we talked about pizza toppings before. So if you are having a burger, whether it's a vegetarian burger, Angus burger, what are you putting on it?
Well, I think there's got to be some kind of cheese, like pepper jack, and the normal condiments with ketchup and lettuce and tomatoes and, you know, things like that. Burgers, some of the best burgers I've had have had some bacon on it, maybe some blue cheese, you know, some different things.
Making me hungry, Crowder.
Yeah, definitely. There are places to get burgers, and then there are places that you just do not get burgers from.
Oh, see, I'm a simple guy, but I would argue the nice thing about my appetite is there's a burger and a chicken tender on every menu, so I'm pretty safe to know that I can get one of those at
chicken tenders.
Any restaurant that I'm at. What do you... All right.
You and your chicken nuggets.
Yeah, and I'm not.
I mean, they are tasty.
Chicken, the nervous bird, too, so I don't eat it often, but because I think it makes you nervous, like Harbaugh said. But go say Medallion, what are you putting on your burger?
I mean, you know, as far as favorite burger goes, there's a lot of great burgers out there, and I'm still always going to be a fan of the Isle of Burger, no matter what I do.
Wow, which is a big Michigan Lansing thing, isn't
it? But if I was to make one at home, what it is usually is cheese. It could be pepper jack. Always got to have cheese, though. You always got to have bacon, and I love me some jalapeno on there, some lettuce, some tomato, and then actually there's this stuff called hell of a good dip, and so in place of like say mayonnaise, they've got this jalapeno cheese one that is just awesome on a burger.
Nice.
Okay,
and it's not something you'd normally put on a burger. It's like it's a chip dip, but I put it on burgers, and I put it on my eggs all the time, too.
That's a great question, because they've, like, just like salad, they've evolved with burgers, what you can put on them or not put them, eggs or cheese. See, I'm a simple guy. I forget. I took for granted cheese. It's got to have cheese on it. I forget that. But simple, I just want ketchup and pickles on it. To go extra, I would prefer bacon on it. But the new one is like these rodeo burgers that have an onion ring and bacon on it. That's kind of been my favorite one recently. Yeah, barbecue sauce. My wife got me hooked on having maybe mayonnaise on your burger. But simply for Lattig, it's ketchup, pickles, and cheese, and then maybe some bacon or an onion ring on there.
See, simple, I'd go just the deluxe mayonnaise, lettuce, tomato.
Okay. And that, you know, the number one in every combo meal, probably pretty much. So we're going to skip my other question because we are where I want to be. So until next time, go Stars.
Stars on Sports is recorded live at the WLNZ Studios. Engineering and production assistance are provided by Dedalian Lowry and Jeremy Robinson. You can listen to this episode and other episodes of Stars on Sports on demand at lccconnect.org. To find more information about our athletic program, visit lccstars.com. Thanks for listening. Go Stars!
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect. Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College Performing Arts is proud to present Summer Stage Under the Stars, featuring a 10-minute play festival directed by Paige Dunkel and Shelley Peterson. Four impressive plays written by LCC students enrolled in Introduction to Theater, and one play written by LCC employee and artist Fred Engelgau. A wonderful variety of styles and concepts for this evening of theater. Featured at LCC's Outdoor Amphitheater, July 23rd through the 27th at 7 p.m. In the event of rain or extreme heat, performances will move into Dart Auditorium. For more information, visit lcc.edu/show-info. All performances are free to attend.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and whatever. Just don't text and drive. Visit stoptextsstoprex.org. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Returning to school can be a challenge. If you're a recent high school grad from 2023 to 2025, a new Michigan Reconnect participant at LCC, or a GED holder, we want to help you succeed with extra support in reading, writing, and math. LCC's Coalition for College and Career Readiness presents College Connect, a 4-week, no-cost initiative created to prepare students with the tools needed to succeed at LCC. Classes begin July 8th and seating is limited. To find more information, visit lcc.edu/cc.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.